in some sense, the most serious weakness in this, all of these models we've done so far of ever-present lambda, which is that we enforce spatial homogeneity. And why do we enforce spatial homogeneity? I'll just say now and then come back, maybe give a little more detail, but the reason we enforce spatial homogeneity is that we don't know how to incorporate a self-consistent model of a varying lambda without spatial homogeneity. And why does spatial homogeneity let us? Well, let me mention something that most of be familiar to most of you, but maybe not everyone, which is if you write the Einstein equations down, and you just say, now let me make lambda be a function of position in space-time, you get, and then you use the Bianchi identities, that is, you take the divergence of the Einstein equations. It immediately pops out that the gradient of lambda is zero. In other words, although you thought you put in a varying lambda, the equations of motion force lambda to be constant. So this means that you can't, that we don't know so far, although I have some new thoughts on it, but we don't know so far any way of allowing lambda to vary. So there would be it would be never present lambda, as someone said, instead of ever present lambda.
So Lee and Juan Magesu.
Oh, I know, there's something with torsion, yeah.
The, well, the first, let me see, the simplest one already includes torsion. But I guess, yeah, it has a term which can be equivalent to torsion, but it satisfies the second Bianchi identity without adding.
Well, maybe you can tell us something about it at some point. Or,
oh, please no.
Okay. You can tell us.
So, classically, weren't people interested in theories where you combine G and lambda?
That is true. So actually, every little comment I was going to make is coming up now. So anyway, when you write the Einstein equations, when I said you forced gradient of lambda, well, why don't I do it? Although there were a few things I wanted to say before. Before launching into this, but anyway, it's pretty familiar. So if you say GAB, so what do I have to put here? I forget. No. This kappa, remember, that's supposed to be kappa. That's everyone's favorite rationalized Newton's constant. So if minus or plus, I think it is, plus lambda times GAB equals GAB. That's the Einstein equation. Right? Now, notice I put the lambda on the left because in my own mind, it's a gravitational effect and not just another dark energy form of fluid or something. But that's just explaining why I wrote it this way. Now, if we take the divergence, covariant divergence, we would get, using the Bianchi identity, we know that the covariant divergence of G is zero. That's inevitable. Maybe not quite inevitable. I may say something about that too. But let's take it for now, inevitable. And if we assume, this is an assumption, in most models, it will be like this. If we assume that the matter stress energy is separately conserved, which ordinarily it will be, then and if we further assume that this is constant, the gravitational constant is constant, then the only thing left when you take the divergence, the only thing left is this term, and you get the gradient of lambda times GAB, okay, which is zero. So therefore, the gradient of lambda must be zero. So that's the usual argument why you can't introduce. If I had to put here a lambda of x, I would find that the gradient of lambda of x is zero. And Marina was saying, or someone was saying,
it was me.
It was you.
Yeah.
So that But why did you have to assume that this is constant? So that is one way out to let this vary. But my impression, and it's only impression, maybe you know more detail, is that the observational tests of varying gravitational constant are so strict, at least for the recent, relatively recent past, that you wouldn't get very far by allowing, even if you let this vary, it wouldn't produce significant amounts of possibility for lambda to vary. If that's not true, then okay. If that's true, then we can abandon that.
CMB constrained variations G or any constant all the way to
nuclear synthesis. Okay, so then forget it. Yeah. In that. Okay.
But of course, you know, in your argument, this is a very strong assumption that divergence of T is equal to zero.
That's strong, there's no
that's the strongest assumption.
Lambda as a function of S is certainly no reason for this, right? Because lambda is really effectively a scalar field, which...
Well, I'm saying it's not. That's why I put it on the left side of the equation.
Right.
But you can mock it up. Of course, you could have...
The energy exchange between T mu nu and then lambda, right?
You could certainly have...
Model. I guess the point is that if you model it as matter, then you would want it combined with the rest of the matter and then have conservation. But if you're saying that it's an entity that's distinct from matter and you want matter to be separate...
Well, then you don't need any matter. You just put T A equals zero and then lambda has to be constant.
I mean,
yeah, I mean, there are many dark energy models, quintessence, and what was this, K essence, and this, and this, and this. All of them have the feature that it's some sort of local field, or local object, like a field. What's distinctive about ever-present lambda is that it's a non-local effect, right? And as well as, of course, quantum and related to discreteness, the three keys that I had up on the board yesterday. But if you could come up with a way of merging this with a non-conserved stress energy, that would certainly be worth looking at. But it's not natural to do that, I think.
Well, if you allow this, it's natural.
I mean, I'm not saying it's not natural to allow it. I'm just saying I don't know a natural way to do it. If you have a suggestion, that would be...
That if you are going to incorporate lambda as matter, then yes, you'd have all of these matter versions. But all the matter that one normally talks about are local quantum fields or local fields of some sort. So how would you model a non-local field? And if you were to do that, would you use the same conservation equations? Because the conservation equation is a local field equation.
I think another way to say it is what...
There's no reason absolutely why divergence of T is equal to zero, right?
Why what?
There's no reason for that.
No, there is a reason. If it's propagating on a background space-time, according to the usual equations of motion, the equations of motion force this to be true.
Coupled to metric or not, so that's the...
Coupled to the metric or...
If you have non-minimal coupling, then of course...
It's got the equations there already. It is minimal.
So this equation.
What do you mean?
So this one will have,
the person just asked that equation.
Yeah, it will have a term for the non-minimal term.
I mean, TAB is simply the variation of the matter Lagrangian with respect to the field. That's it. I mean, that's it.
If you just have, your matter only goes
to the
metric, then that's what you get. But if it couples to...
So whatever the coupling, it's going to just be the variation of, I mean, by definition, TEB is simply the variation of the matter Lagrangian with respect to the matter action with respect to the...
All you're saying.
I mean, if we do that, I'm not...
With T, that's all you're saying.
That what? Say it again.
No, I'm saying...
No, what did Alan...
The reason to separate it is
No, I'm asking what Alan said. I didn't hear what he said.
The idea is if you take the variation, it diverges less. But if you actually just simply write the Lagrangian down as T plus lambda, and it's the total that's divergent, the divergentness.
Right.
Okay. So there's no reason why it has to be zero.
T plus lambda. What is T?
Yeah. So
I mean, the reason you get lambda on the left hand side is because it's sitting there.
So grand lambda plus divergence of T
is
lambda.
Because it's lambda squared
root
of
constant.
G.
Can only sit on
the other side. So there could be interaction between lambda. So if lambda is
yes, that's what I was about to say. If, I mean, this is to me definition of the cosmological class. If you, of course, there are more complicated scalar tensor theories and so on, where you might not even have this term on the left hand side. I mean,
it's a question of how you define the Lagrangian. If you define it with respect to a constant, then yes.
But I think this is, if you had a suggestion on how to make this interact with this, that would be worth, I mean, I think that would be realizing what you're saying. That would be worth exploring. But it's not, well, how would you make it, where do you want to put the scalar then? You want to put something?
I mean, you would put the scalar in front of the metric. Or again.
So now you would be introducing a new field, right? So, a minimal approach is to say we just have all the standard model, or we have the matter that we know, but there's something about gravity, which is this, which makes lambda fluctuate. So that's a minimal thing. But yes, if you introduce more matter, I mean, as I was saying before, then you could have a quintessence model of lambda, or you could have a quiescence model. You wouldn't need fluctuating lambda at all. So there's an infinite, you know, field there of possible theories that you can explore. But this to me, but I don't know a simple way, I don't know any way of sticking with just these fields and this equation and making lambda vary. And precisely because this will be true
in
such a model.
When you say it's the matter you know, it's not, is it? It's
an
energy momentum tensor, and if you're going to look at the cosmological context,
yeah,
some coarse-grained version of the energy momentum of the underlying field.
Well, that's true.
Which includes gravitational fields, and so in a sense, there's no guarantee that it has to be conserved.
I don't get that. I don't get what you're saying.
What is TAB? Is it a perfect fluid?
No. Well, in some approximation, it may be, and sometimes, yeah. It may be a two-component fluid, or it has relativist, it has radiation. It may be you're using a Boltzmann code to evolve it, but it's...
It's actually obtained by taking fundamental physics,
yes,
coarse-graining, to,
yeah,
get some sort of continuum object. And that continuum object would involve gravitational contributions, possibly. So it's not clear to me you do have to impose that being concerned.
At the very least, so when you have started with fundamental particle fields,
yeah,
and then to go from that to T-milieu,
yes,
an ensemble, or you could say volume average of,
yeah,
all of those fields, if your volume is somehow stochastically varying with time, that would also impact the average T.
Okay, so you're saying that just the coarse graining involved in doing cosmology could produce an effect of stress energy that wasn't conserved. If that's true, it's very, then that'll if that is true, then it will automatically force a varying lambda. So that would be very, very interesting. So if someone could show why that's the case, you would have shown that lambda cannot be constant, or something else has to be changed. Right? So more power to anyone who has such an idea.
What I'm confused about is that if you were to start off with a Lagrangian formulation, where you have this as a separate term and the matter field as a separate term, whatever you do, I mean, at the end of the day, it comes from a variation of the metric. And so even if you put lambda as a function of x, I mean, think of it as some random field, it doesn't matter what, but it's appearing boldly like this. It's not appearing as a derivative. So even if you want to call it, there's no associated, I mean, So if I take a variation with respect to GAB, I'm just going to get exactly
the only
I'm not going to get anything else but this term.
That's right, but there is a caveat, which is that when you coarse grain sufficiently, you may not get a variational.
Sure.
You may not get there may be no Lagrangian. And
right.
And in fact,
so
typically
you go into the stochastic theory, then you have to sort of
show
that you get out a stochastic thing because you've coarse grained and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, even if friction or viscosity becomes important, then you're already beyond the naive Lagrangian formulation. However, the Navier-Stokes equations don't violate this condition.
That's fine.
And I mean, this is usually one of robust things that survives when you do coarse graining. So, but I don't mean to argue against that. I think that's fair. If someone could show that by carefully thinking through how the coarse graining needs to go, that in fact this was not conserved. Well, I'm just repeating what I said. First of all, it's very interesting. All the models that most people use would have to be adjusted, right? And then, second of all, it seems like it would give us an automatic varying lambda. So that's...
Interacting dark energy is exactly of that form, isn't it?
But what is interacting dark energy?
Well, you have two components to TAB.
Yeah, but that's another...
Conserved. So there's an interaction.
But when you put it by hand, you're not getting it from some fundamental.
You're adding.
This is an interaction.
But now you're adding new. You're hypothesizing new fields. Coarse graining is just a question of taking what we know already, and scaling it up with sufficient care to the scale in which we can do cosmology. I think that's a different thing. I'm not so enthusiastic about just inventing new fields. I mean. It gives a lot of work to a lot of people. And
nothing else.
There's no harm.
You're against employment. You want to.
there's no harm in it, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's not my, passion. Let's say. But I do think it's obvious. Everyone has to face this question: what is the effect of coarse graining on the microscopic theory?
So you've already said that one of the problems with the approach is the fact you have to assume spatial homogeneity.
Yes, I was going to start. This was all just meant as a brief introduction to show why we need to.
If you actually had the generic case of inhomogeneous models, and somehow your homogeneous model came from coarse graining, then who knows what conditions those averaged energy momentum tensors would satisfy? It probably wouldn't be conserved because
maybe that would be fine. That'd be wonderful. Let's see. I mean, someone should study this. I mean, another thing that can be said that's related to what you're saying is even more elementary. Is that this thing does? You said it before, actually. I think this thing doesn't take into account the energy and momentum of the gravitational field itself. We know that you can't do that, or essentially we know that you cannot do that on a fundamental level. But after coarse graining, it can certainly have some effect, like if you have a neutron star or something. I mean, gravitational energy is certainly in there. So again, yeah, there's conceptual issues here with what do we mean by TAB in the cosmological context. And it could happen that when we understand better what we mean by it, that we see that it's not conserved. So now, yeah.
So just saying that this coarse graining would give you is equivalent of some sort of an Einstein-Langevin equation where you would have fluctuation and people have studied, I mean, Balog, who is one person who studied this a lot.
That's coarse graining.
You could do, again, with coarse graining, you had sort of, now, I mean, there they think of stochasticity coming from quantum fields, but here it could come just from quantum gravity. So I think that would be nice to build a model which actually did that kind of coarse graining.
We have done things along those directions, which I think is more correct than what Balog has done. But I don't think you get ever present lambda out of that. So.
This is how we're looking at quantum, well, of course, which we want to do, but that's looking at quantum effects, right? Quantum effects. But I think the question has come up, what if you even did, I don't actually know, is the context quantum or classical, but the question is there as a classical question. What if you just assumed that on small scale you had classical field equations for the fields we have? You'd already have this issue of coarse graining. Of course, ultimately, you want the deep fundamental one to be quantum, and that raises even more issues. But anyway, let me just finish this. So this forces, at the moment, not knowing how to introduce, for example, interactions between this and this, this seems to force lambda to be constant. Now there's one, I wasn't even going to mention this since we've spent so much discussion on it so far. There's a caveat. What about stochastic metric? Because in this, at least especially in the model one, which you haven't heard yet what it is really, but the behavior of lambda is like Brownian motion. It's a very stochastic. So it's not differentiable. So the metric, that feeds back into the metric. So the metric, I think, loses one derivative. So in order to actually write down, the Einstein equation, you already have to take a couple of derivatives of the metric. And in order to believe in this identity, which involves another derivative, you have to be able to take three derivatives of the metric. If the metric is not sufficiently smooth, none of that makes, at some point it starts breaking down and doesn't make sense. You cannot actually derive this. It seems to me that's a logical loophole, although I don't know any way to take advantage of it. And it seems more technical, mathematical in nature than physical. So I don't know that anyone has ever really explored it seriously, but I just mentioned that there is a loophole in this derivation that you might overcome when this dependence on space was not smooth in the case of lambda. Sufficiently rough.
But I mean, the advantage is doing causal sets. I guess that's what people are trying to do. That.
Yeah.
Some people.
Some people should. There's a limit. There's many statements. I mean, many things about what one could say in relation to causal sets that someone should look at this. I certainly.
Blackboard.
Yeah, I could.
We need employment.
It is what we are trying to solve here. Sorry. I
was just going to say that if there are terms that are truly stochastic, then the regime that we're looking at is stochastic differential equations, where solutions are going to be where integrals are zero, sort of things that we call weak solutions, whatever. So I'm not entirely sure what the smoothness, what the relevance of smoothness is going to be.
But
the context is going to be slightly different, isn't it?
Well, the question is, if you define stochastic differential, if you use the technology of stochastic differential equations, which actually I've never seen it in the context of PDEs, but only of ODEs, but maybe someone has developed for partial differential equations too. Do you know if they have?
I believe so, yeah.
So that's good. So if that technology is there, it would be well worth looking at this and to see what becomes of this derivation using this as a stochastic differential equation. That's really the question I'm raising. If we treat this as a stochastic differential equation or whatever the right terminology is, what becomes of this derivation? Does it make it now consistent to allow lambda to be spatially varying? That would be a startling result. but I'd love to know the answer. But anyway, that's not the way we've gone, of course. Let me just say two more things. This was just meant to end as an introduction to say why we forced ourselves to use spatial homogeneity. So in full generality, we don't know how to allow lambda to vary. You can't just specify, I'd like it to vary in this way, this way, this way, because you hit this contradiction. However, if you impose spatial homogeneity, then as every cosmologist knows, the full Einstein equations, all 10 of them, reduce to just two ordinary differential equations, right? Which are, I don't know if this is the right terminology, but the first Friedman equation and the second Friedman equation, or is that?
You mean isotropy and spatial homogeneity?
Yeah.
I meant that, yeah. I don't think you need the isotropy, but then you'd have the Bianchi type, you'd have more possible spatial metrics. But in fact, I think everything would still go through. If someone really believed we were living in a Bianchi 7 or whatever, you could still do, I think, the same model 1 and model 2 ever-present lambda for those. So the really important thing is the spatial homogeneity. But you're right. To get to the standard Friedman equations, we need isotropy. So, and of course, we're also assuming flatness, which you don't have to, as we heard, spatial flatness. But the important thing is, now you're down to two ordinary differential equations. And this fact, that this inconsistency here manifests itself in the form, this is the what people, if they just say Friedman equation, this is the equation that they mean, right? It's rho matter, that equation. But where this, of course, is Hubble's constant, Hubble's parameter, Hubble something. What is this called? Hubble's constant, Hubble's parameter? I call it Hubble constant, but it's not. I mean, I like to say that the cosmological constant is just as constant as Hubble's constant,
yeah.
Both in historical sense and time dependence. But anyway, you get this equation, and then you get a second equation, which I won't write out because I don't even remember the coefficients, but it involves in it second time derivatives of A. And this one is just the Hamiltonian constraint by another name. What you find is that with constant lambda, this equation basically follows from taking the time derivative. The second equation, which has one more time derivative, follows from taking the time derivative of the first equation. And it's essentially redundant in the context of the homogeneous cosmology. However, if you now make lambda vary, you find that the first derivative, time derivative of this equation is inconsistent with that equation. That's how this inconsistency up here manifests itself. So the...
Unless you have a conservation equation for
lambda. You need to also use conservation of...
Unless you have lambda dot equation somewhere.
Yes, you can modify. I mean, when I said that this followed from this, we're using the whatever conservation of energy equation or whatever you call that equation. And that's right. And so we have to assume an equation of state. If you allow the equation of state to depend on lambda dot, then you can make them consistent. That's true. But I don't know how to. And so far, that gains us nothing because we don't know how to. Say analyze perturbations or so on with this equation of state.
Sorry, I walked out when you were discussing something.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you came back to that, but I would naively think that the coarse graining procedure for getting T mu nu out of your meta fields.
Yeah.
Would be sensitive to the same kind of stochastic change in your volume as the one that causes lambda. So maybe that's the answer, that changes in lambda imply a change in this averaged
for
meta, because that depends on the volume over which you average.
Well, you don't coarse grain over the whole cosmos, right? I mean, you just coarse grain over relatively small regions, a few parsecs or something. I don't know what it is.
Isn't your integral over the entire phase space?
Which integral?
Calculate T-menu.
Wait, sorry.
It's a function of x. Sorry, it's a function of x and t. And you integrate over momenta.
What do you mean by momentum? You mean like in the Boltzmann equation?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a local, in space time, that's a local, essentially local integration. So, yeah, if that volume were to be changed, which I've never even thought about, I don't know if anyone has thought about that. I don't immediately see the connection to the.
So again, I didn't quite catch that last thing that was said.
He's saying when you.
If you were to integrate, if you want to find T mu nu as some integral over all momenta, all Fourier modes that are in your horizon.
Oh, that's.
Or inside different. Your entire universe. Yeah, like horizon, I guess, yeah.
But then.
It
then
cutoff determined by.
That's true, but then your T mu nu would be homogeneous by construction, wouldn't it?
Everything would be homogeneous
by construction, because you've integrated out all the variations over the horizon.
Presumably, in the cosmological context, you're integrating over some scale comparable to the horizon size or something. And yes, the volume plays a part in the integration. And if the volume is changing, if it's the stochastic, it will affect the averaging of the energy momentum.
Yeah. So there are two. I thought you were talking, at least momentarily, about integrating over momentum. I thought you really meant just wave number. But I thought you really meant like a Boltzmann equation where you have these constituents
at
with.
At that time, I did mean it, because that's how T mu nu is.
Yeah.
But then you consider excitations of your quantum fields of all momenta, and then T mu nu would be integral over all this momentum.
Yes, that's true, but I still think it's an essentially local, it's a local Fourier transform or something like that. It presumably doesn't have, well, it's something to think about, but I don't see any connection between that and the space-time integral that we're doing in order to derive the lambda fluctuation.
If you go down that path, firstly, it's no longer true that the averaged Einstein tensor is the Einstein tensor of the average metric, because the volume is changing. And secondly, nobody knows how to average tensors in GL. So it's a hard problem.
Yeah, there are significant conceptual issues there. And how we pass from micro, or let's say mesoscopic or something physics to cosmological scale physics. Let me just finish this little story. So, because this is the explanation of why we have forced ourselves to spatial homogeneity up to this point. And the as I just described, if we don't worry about exotic equations of state involving lambda dot itself, then there's and if we assume the matter is separately conserved, then there's an incompatibility between the first Friedmann equation, also known as the Hamiltonian constraint, and the second Friedmann equation, which sometimes we call the acceleration equation. So our solution has been basically just ignore this equation, and then interpret lambda in terms of its role in this equation. we only were able, even that's not the most satisfactory. And I could mention some work that was done by Maqbul Ahmed about, well, what would happen if, suppose you took this equation as your basic equation, not this equation, or some linear combination of these two equations. That's actually quite interesting. You learn some interesting things by thinking about that. But let me put it off for now and just say, we've taken this equation to be our definition. We don't know any analog of doing that in the full inhomogeneous case. It's only because we were able to boil down the Einstein equations into these two ordinary differential equations, and then, in a well-defined way, select one of them, that we were able to make the models, the first model and the second model. So that's the explanation of why we've had spatial homogeneity built in so far. And one comment, maybe I'll just make it as a comment. I won't fill it in now, because I wanted to just make one list, sort of provocative, of further predictions from ever-present lambda. Because it's getting late. I don't know how long we want to. One of our organizers has left. And the other one has a vested interest in staying longer. But yeah, so maybe we should try not to go too much longer. What did we do yesterday? We went to about...
I have to leave very, very shortly.
Okay, so anyway,
we'll be meeting for dinner, maybe.
Yeah.
There's no reason we can't.
No, I won't stay. So anyway, let me just say in words, you might ask, well, this is just some sort of calculation. It comes from the Bianchi identities, and the Bianchi identities, if you know the one possible derivation of them, they can be related to diffeomorphism invariants. So can we give a deeper explanation of why lambda is being forced to be constant, coming more directly from diffeomorphism invariants? And I'm claiming that you can actually do that. You just see, you write down the Lagrangian from which you derive the Einstein equation, and you just use diffeomorphism invariance in a very simple way, and you see that what happens is that for consistency, lambda itself is forced to be diffeomorphism invariant. That means you can't specify, that means it can't depend on coordinates, and that's the origin of this incompatibility. But it also suggests a way out of the incompatibility, which I just started to think about a couple of days ago because of this conference, basically. But it has its own problems, but I just want to mention it because it's kind of an interesting direction. What's inconsistent is to specify lambda as a fixed function of x and then try and write this equation. But x has no meaning, right? What you want is lambda as a fixed function of some geometrically meaningful location. If you do that, I think you'll actually get consistent equations. But the one that I tried this is the notorious problem of observables, or sometimes it goes by the name the problem of time in general relativity. The problem of time is used to mean more things, but the problem of observables, how do you write down diffeomorphism of invariant observables? It's those kind of things on which lambda could self-consistently depend. One way to do it is to use integrals. And that's what I started to play with. In fact, the same integral that goes into defining the lambda fluctuations, which Nocipio will explain. But if you do that, you can write an action principle, but you get an anticipating equation. In other words, you get a field equation in which you need to know something about the future as well as the past in order to evolve forward in time. That's, I think, not practical or not feasible. But I think it might be a proof of principle. In other words, it does show that there is a way to allow lambda to vary if you make its value depend on real observables, if you want that word, diffeomorphism invariant quantities. Okay, so that was that. And
so lambda, it emerges as something that depends on the fluctuations in the volume as the more volume sets come in.
Yeah, yeah.
Lambda responds to that. So are you saying that instead of lambda of x, it should be lambda over the integral over O x?
Or the past light cone or something, yeah. And then when you say that the lambda at some point is related to some integral over the past light cone, the particular one I tried was some function, some specified function of the volume of the past light cone. That would be what would happen in one realization of the model. So
that's what you already do in your paper, right? Lambda actually is.
We actually do use that. Yes, we do actually do that, and then we use this equation. But this equation was pulled out of our hat, this is just coming from this equation. If you could go back to the fundamental action principle. And put a lambda defined in that way, then you would get consistent equations. But they would no longer be just simply the Einstein equations. They'd be some integral differential, some sort of non-local.
In the Lagrangian itself.
Yeah, I mean, that would be one way, because normally, not always, but normally, when you get something from variational principle, you don't get inconsistencies. I think that the origin of this inconsistency it didn't come from a variational principle. So.
It makes sense that lambda shouldn't be just a function of x.
But then you wouldn't get then a
you can't just,
equation anymore, you'd get an integral difference.
Yeah, if you use a non-local expression, which would be natural, yes. What you can't do is just paint lambda on the manifold on the spacetime and say, this is my lambda, because you don't know where those points are. Really, you have to paint them on some physically meaningful background. It's the old covariance bugaboo that makes gravity hard, but quantum gravity much harder. So I wanted to mention, I mean, I had a whole bunch of a long list, which I thought I would not get through, but in fact, I didn't even get to start the list. So. Although we jumped ahead to one of the points of the list that I was going to skip for lack of time. There are three sort of predictions that come out of this ever-present lambda, which it's always interesting if there are predictions. And one of them is this fantasy I was talking about the other day. The first one has actually been tested, interestingly enough, but I don't think anyone is going to get all excited by the fact that experiment agreed with it. So, I mean, causal sets have this capacity to make predictions that somehow are not going to seem like the most surprising thing to come down the pike. So the one prediction causal sets makes is that there won't be closed causal curves. That's been tremendously well verified so far. But it's interesting that it is actually a prediction. It's not, the whole causal set idea is not compatible with closed. I could say why. Not just because in the definition of POSET we built in the absence of causal curves, but because you can't consistently relax it to allow for closed causal curves. And so here's a prediction: is that no? This is a pre-LHC prediction. No big extra dimensions, right? There was a hope that some version of a Kaluza-Klein or this other, what is it called, the Randall syndrome or something like that, where there would be, where the true Planck length, the true string length or whatever your theory was not actually 10 to the minus 32 centimeters, but it was really millimeter or anyway, one TeV scale or something like that. If you go through the thing that I discussed yesterday, the logic, the heuristic logic that leads to the fluctuating lambda, then if you assume that the lambda we see are the fluctuations, you can repeat the same derivation in these large extra dimension, these Kaluza-Klein models. And what happens is that the effect of gravitational constant changes, and then you have, because you have to do an integral over the volume, and furthermore, the Planck length has to change in order, because you have to do this integral over the volume to get the effect of gravitational constant. So both the Planck length changes and the the relation between the Planck length and gravitational constant changes, and the volume changes, so the relation between number of elements and four-dimensional volume also changes. When you sort through the effects of that, you find that the fluctuations are much, much smaller. So it means that lambda is too small. It's already pretty small, right? It's way smaller in this model. So if ever-present lambda is lambda, then there should not be, you know, they shouldn't have seen many black holes at the LHC. So that's one prediction. Another prediction was, this one you'll have to wait about 14 billion years or more to test. another prediction, I mean, because lambda is fluctuating, and because there's no limit to how much you can fluctuate, except in model two where it was artificial, well, maybe most people will discuss. But if lambda, see, let's go back to this, where we use this equation. I guess I should say, you can also, there's another equation here, as I mentioned before. You could use it instead, or you can use some combination. It turns out that if you use this one instead, it's completely unstable. You can't use this one. It's kind of an interesting fact. That although this equation is somehow just a constant of integration of this equation by itself is unstable and does not lead to a consistent theory. I think that's closely related to the instabilities that people had for so many years when they were trying to do numerical gravity, because this is the Hamiltonian constraint, and if you relax it, you tend to evolve away from it in an exponential way. In any case, that equation cannot be used, but some linear combination of these two equations can be used. And depending, and then it turns out that using this alone, which is what models one and model two did, is a special case a reason I'll say in a second. If we look at this equation, suppose lambda fluctuates so much negative that the left-hand side becomes negative, what'll happen? Suppose this becomes, so.
You have to write it on the other side.
Yeah, I have to write it the other way to say it simply. No, I'll write it this way. Suppose it becomes so negative that this sum becomes negative, then this equation has no solution. So in the numerical simulations, you can just quit and throw that out and try again. And or what you can do, this is a nice fantasy game to play also, is what you can do. You can say, well, maybe some quantum thing happens at that point, some tunneling, something, but there's no definite theory of what happens there. That's what happens here. If you use some linear combination of these two equations, then you can keep going because it has an A double dot term, but it changes the sign. So what happens is that the cosmos starts contracting instead of expanding. And usually when it starts contracting, the fluctuations in lambda are not big enough, and you can never get out of that. It's just in a death spiral, or it dives back down to zero size, and it never reaches the present era. In other words, because if you start this, you know, at very early time, pre everything that people think about it, you start at that early time and then evolve it forward. You just find it never gets large enough. A never gets large enough to be the present time. Now, either way, when this fluctuates negative, some sort of disaster happens in the sense that you can't reproduce our universe. Now the interesting thing is, the interesting thing was what's special about four dimensions. But before I say that, what this says is, no matter what the probability distribution for the lambda is, if you wait long enough, it'll fluctuate so negative that this will happen. And then depending on which exact model you have, it'll just, you can't continue, the universe dies or something. Or some quantum thing happens. Anyway, something completely unlike what we live in now happens. Or it starts recontracting and there's a big crunch. So
just to comment that I think that's also consistent with, I mean, something I can bring up later, but I think it's consistent with what we expect of a continuum approximation. Continuum approximation for a manifold which is non-compact, breaks down because the fact that you have potentially large voids, that arbitrary large voids that can happen in a non-compact space.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And which means that somehow the idea of the continuum breaks down in the infinite volume limit.
That is also
so
true.
I think that this would be consistent with that. This would be nice because then it would say that. So at some level, the.
That might be even in bigger value. You might have to wait even more than 14 billion years to see that. To see that. I think didn't we do this calculation where the biggest void, the probability of getting a nuclear-sized void is in the whole history of the cosmos is some negligible.
So far.
So zero or something.
That's just too far for our couple of
ones. Anyway, so the prediction is ultimately the present phase of expansion will come to an end. So it's completely a different kind of picture than what people talk about, where you have a constant lambda, where it's just this endless expansion with nothing happening, entropy going, sort of stabilizing at some huge number, black holes evaporating, and basically nothing. So I think one should be, well, it's pretty obvious, but one should be careful about forecasting the infinite future from any particular theory. But if you do it, then we have a forecast, which is most likely some sort of collapse or other dramatic quantum effect happening. And that brings up the other thing. When you simulate these models, you have to make sure what do you say if the model produces a collapse or a catastrophe almost every time, and you have to run into the simulation a million times until you get one that expands to our size? I don't know if you say that the model is bad and you say, oh, well, the anthropic principle says we're here, so I don't know. But fortunately, that doesn't happen. So it reaches the present time in a significant amount, significant fraction of the cases, unless you tune your fluctuations to be very too big. But ultimately, this will always happen. But what if you had run the model in a different dimension? So that's the last point I want to make, that there's something special about four dimensions, which is very easy to see. In the context of ever-present lambda, there's something very special about four dimensions. It's the critical dimension. So if you the Einstein equations are a balance between gravity and matter, as you often think. But in this case, the important balance is between gravity and the fluctuating cosmological constant, which, because of the quote-unquote ever-present, they're always somehow comparable to each other. If one of them should become much more important than the other, well, if lambda became the most important, you would get, I don't know, some disastrous... you'd get this recollapse to happen or this disaster to happen very quickly because the fluctuations would be not able to be controlled by the geometry. In the other case, you would be more like not having a fluctuating lambda, and then you'd have to look in what would happen. But I think this is true, but I'm not sure in higher dimensions. Maybe someone knows. And if, at least if you assume the closed space-time, then you would be guaranteed a recollapse. But is that special to four dimensions? If you assume the spherical space-time with pure matter, say radiation or dust, does it always recollapse? Anyway, I think that, let me, since no one is here to say no, let me say yes, that that's true. And then the typical dimensional analysis, I mean, if you start at the Planck time, the typical lifetime of this cosmos is about a Planck time. So you'd have essentially, again, the universe would not last long enough to reach its big size that we have now. So it's only because there's a nice balance between these two terms that the universe is able to get big. And now I'll show
you. If you have a non-zero cosmological constant, it doesn't matter if it's closed, it's gonna expand forever.
But it's fluctuating. It's the lambda is fluctuating.
If it's fluctuating.
Yeah, that's only the whole area, yeah, absolutely. It's based on the fluctuations.
So what is
it's because if the fluctuations in lambda swamp the effect of the Ricci curvature, then you'll get this recollapse, or you'll hit this problem where the right-hand side becomes negative very quickly.
But I thought that, if the dimension is, say, five dimensions, the dimensions are five, you're saying that lambda term dominates over?
Let's see, what have I written here? It's that if lambda term lambda dominates its lower dimensions below four.
Below four.
And
it becomes small.
And curvature dominates at dimensions above four. So lambda becomes negligible.
Oh, I see, okay.
And it's just hand wave.
Consistent with what you've written about the large extra dimensions.
Oh, I see, I hadn't thought of that. Because that's a higher dimensional.
So there you're saying that the fluctuations are too small in higher dimensions.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't made that connection, but maybe that's actually at the root of it. I just did some little calculation. It led to that result. So here's the calculation. So we just want to compare. I'll just finish with this. We want to compare the two terms in the action. With each other and see in which dimension one is bigger and which dimension one is smaller. And we're doing it using the same utter hand-waving thing that we did yesterday to derive the fact that lambda is expected to be ever-present in four dimensions. So again, here we have this cosmos. The scale is set by h, typical length scale, which I'll just call L inverse, the couple. This being the Hubble radius. Let's assume that everything just comes from that one scale, then the scale of the typical value of the curvature is just, it's an inverse length squared, so it'll just, cosmologically speaking, it'll just be 1 over L squared. And the typical value, then we have to multiply it by V, I guess, which is typically L to the fourth, that's really going to drop out. But somehow I didn't foresee that when I wrote these notes. And the other one is, now the important thing is, remember lambda was scaling like 1 over the square root of V, which is, and this is L to the D. I want to make this in an arbitrary dimension now, the volume based on L to the D. So that's 1 over L to the D over 2. So this one will be like, this is just lambda V, which will be scaling like 1 over L to the D over 2 times L to the D. So if we're just comparing these two, then in the ratio, it doesn't matter. And the question is just, which is bigger? So L is a large number. So this is the lambda. So if D is greater than 4, then D over 2 is greater than 2. And so this 1 over L, the higher power, makes the lambda term negligible. On the other hand, if D is less than 4, then this, you know, this is a slower fall off than this. And so the lambda term dominates. So the statement is that for D less than 4, what did I say? Lambda dominates. For D greater than 4, well, RAB, let's say, dominates, the geometry dominates. And then, of course, for D equals 4, they're balanced. So that's in the sense in which 4 dimensions is the critical dimension for a fluctuating lambda cosmology. And then you can tell a nice story, and then I don't know if I should, well, why not? So why is, no, in causal sets, there's nothing that forces the dimension to be 4 or anything. And, I mean, that's one of its strengths, but it's also one of its weaknesses, because not only does it not force the dimension to be any particular value, it's not even forced to be a manifold of any dimension. That's what makes it hard. I was going to include even a speculation on that, but I certainly won't on that. But in any case, if it wants to be a manifold, it could be a manifold of any dimension. So what about it starts, there's a kind of initial big bang, or maybe just the next big bang after the last cycle. It starts to try to expand. It doesn't want to have a dimension that's too large. That's wasteful of the causal set element. Like I was saying, you couldn't have a dimension over 500 or so, using the number of elements available to us in the whole history of the universe. So maybe it starts trying to be dimension 2, 1 plus 1, but then lambda dominates, so it fluctuates very quickly and it collapses or some goes into a quantum phase, a non-geometric phase. Or it tries again with some other dimension, 5, you know. And then the other thing happens, it recollapses very quickly because of just the usual Einstein equation. It just keeps trying, and then finally it tries 4, and then it's able to keep going. It says, of course.
Freedom.
You're free. Yeah, I mean, it's still not out of the woods entirely. But if it makes it past the first few years, or the first few whatever, then it gets to us, maybe 20%, maybe 80% of the time or something. It makes it to our size. So anyway, that makes a nice story on why, a just-so story on why do we live in dimension 4.
Just-so as in Rudyard Kipling?
People call, I suppose I shouldn't be quoting anything from Kipling.
He wrote very well. So.
He was a good writer, yeah. He was, in other ways, not so admirable. He talked about something about the wars of, he's one of the first Orwellian people. He wrote a poem about the wars of peace, which were the colonial wars that the English were involved in. The wars for peace. Anyway, never mind. So that makes a nice just so story about why we live in 4 dimensions. And it's just, there are many possible answers, of course, to why we live in 4 dimensions. But this is kind of a feeling other possibility. I think I won't, the other points I was going to say, my one point was unfinished aspects of the work, and that would have been longer than all the others. But we did sort of address the most important one in that long discussion.
These arguments are assuming that between every quantum, whatever this collapse quantum regime, between two quantum regimes of this sort collapse, there is a geometric phase that actually comes into being. And if it did
come
into being, then it would collapse if the dimension wasn't right.
Actually, yeah.
So the point is somehow that there is a version of the Einstein Hilbert action that comes into play.
Exactly. Yeah, you might. Now, there are dimensional arguments, like RG arguments, like if there's any action at all, it'll be something. The leading terms will be like the Einstein-Hilberts, like the RG action. There was some other thing that I wanted to say. Yeah, it could happen that it spends a lot of time in a non-geometric phase. And if you want me to file a speculation on speculation, I can say that it's even likely that it spends a lot of time in a non-geometric. By a lot of time, what do I mean? There's no time. I mean a large number of causal set elements have to be born, which is like space-time volume roughly, before you get out of the non-geometric phase. And that's based on something, that's based on Euclidean, on what shall I call it? It's based on something that I mentioned the other day. For those who were here at that time, I said that quantum gravity had made two predictions. One of them came true and one of them did not. And
Goldman's
Yeah, there was the prediction that lambda should be exactly zero, that is exponentially close to zero. And there was the prediction that this prediction of the ever-present lambda. And I said that the prediction of being exponentially close to zero was wrong. The reason it was wrong, it was based on Euclidean quantum gravity. And they tried to compute an amplitude for arriving at a space-time of, what was the, arriving at a space-time of, so it's a Euclidean prediction, so it's like a tunneling prediction. You want to produce, given lambda, given the value of lambda, you want, there's some 8 pi here or some 2 pi, or I forget what it is, there's some number here. And then, of course, there's a prefactor that no one knows how to compute. But this is the saddle point approximation. And so if you fix lambda, then there's a particular size De Sitter space that can be compatible with that, you know, implied by that lambda. So this is meant to be the amplitude, the tunnel to a condition where it can then continue classically as a classical De Sitter space with that value of lambda. And they got this value using Euclidean quantum gravity, or they claimed to get this value using Euclidean quantum gravity. Well, I mean, they did get it, but there are some rules. You know, Euclidean quantum gravity is not a totally well-defined scheme. So, but they used the rule, I think, of take the biggest saddle point or something. So anyway, whatever rule they used, they got this value. And so you see that this is exponentially diverging. The smaller lambda, well, unless lambda is negative, then it's kind of damped. But if lambda is a positive small number, this thing blows up. So the argument was that it's sort of infinitely more likely for lambda to be, you had to make lambda dynamical somehow. That was one way that these wormholes came in, and Sydney's work came in connection with that. But if lambda, this infinitely favors an infinitely small positive lambda. So that was the argument. So lambda is almost surely zero or something. This is a preamble to what I wanted to say about why I think that the causal set would spend a very long time in the non-geometric phase. Is that this calculation I claim was wrong. Wrong, right, who knows? But wrong if you accept a certain starting point. And the starting point is we should be doing a Lorentzian path integral, and this should just be some sort of analytic continuation in order to evaluate approximately evaluate a Lorentzian path integral. If you set it up that way, then there are unambiguous rules for doing the analytic continuation, and they lead, of course, to a tunneling amplitude, just like you see in WKB, but of course, as you would expect, it leads to the minus sign. That's unambiguous. So what this does is it, as you might expect, it disfavors a very small positive lambda. because that would mean it had to be tunneled. The universe would have to tunnel to some gigantic size before it could get started as a classical world. So it favors, you know, a Planckian size. But if you set lambda to be at present Hubble scale, and you ask how long would you have to wait to tunnel to that? I mean, if you interpret this as the tunneling rate, which is in fact how it is in these instant time calculations of decay of the vacuum and so on, then it just means you have to wait exponentially long in order for it. This is just a speculation, a fantasy, but what I've told you here is a hard calculation, but the interpretation I'm giving now is just a fantasy. But let's interpret this way as a waiting time, and it measured in Planck units, in causal set units, then it just tells you how many elements have to be born before you can enter a geometric phase with some reasonable lambda. So I think that's not at all an unreasonable thing, that when the universe recollapses, it enters some sort of quantum phase, some non-geometric phase, and then it just remains in that for a very long time until it can try another dimension. It's just a picture.
Is he saying that if you did the Lorentzian path and then did the right angle to continuation, that this is the right probability?
That's right.
But again, for very small lambda, which is now negative,
this was for positive. What happened with negative lambda? I don't think I computed. This was for, I mean, I did it for a sphere. I'm trying to remember. I think I did it for a spherical. I'm pretty sure I did it for a spherical space, so that I don't.
Did you do this with your mouth?
That's a good question. No, this was after that.
But is it written up or no?
Yeah, it's written up. It's a paper. It's public. It's called is the metric Euclidean or Lorentzian or something?
That's in that one. Okay.
But that's a good point. What happens? I mean, I did tunneling at fixed lambda. I guess there wouldn't have been a saddle point. That's a good question. What would have happened if we had put in a negatively curved? Well, the first thing is you have to compactify it somehow. You can certainly do that. I don't think that's going to affect. It affects the isotropy, but it's not going to affect. You could still do a sort of mini superspace calculation for that. Yeah, what would have happened? I'll just make a guess. And beyond that, I mean, you could do it for flat. That's even easier. Do it for a...
Yeah, for any toroid.
You're tunneling at lambda equals zero. Do it for a torus, yeah. What would happen? Yeah, that's a good... If I have to make a guess, not very confidently, I would say you won't find a saddle point. But I'm not sure. Yeah, should look at that.